Good morning, everyone. This morning we have three matters on our calendar, and we'll call the first case, Hill v. Cosby, appellate number 16-1362.
Honors, may it please the Court, my name is George Contos. I'm here on behalf of Renita Hill, who is filed against Bill Cosby. I'm here with Claire McGee of my office. I'd like to take 10 minutes for my main argument.
You want 10 minutes, and 5 minutes for rebuttal?
5 minutes for rebuttal.
That's granted.
I'd like to begin by discussing context in relationship to the issues that are before this Court. Context explains a lot about the jurisprudence in the area. It explains, for example, how you can have some cases where very highly inflammatory words like blackmail or extort or paranoid schizophrenic have been found not to be capable of defamatory meaning. And you can have other instances in which rather innocuous language, take for example the Oprah Winfrey case or the Weinstein case, where there was a police officer who made various statements that really on their face were quite benign, and yet they were found to be defamatory.
I think you make a good point about asking about context and focusing on Mr. Singer's statement. He's speaking as, you hold him out as a lawyer. Assume
Right.
for the purposes of this question that Mr. Cosby could be responsible for his statements because you're only defending. Doesn't the context in which that his statement matters, meaning he was a lawyer making statements, our court in Remick thought that mattered, that it was a lawyer speaking? So apropos your point, doesn't context allow a listener to make a judgment as to how to evaluate what Mr. Singer said?
It absolutely does, Your Honor, and I think the fact that he is an attorney, and I just point out that you have cases where attorneys have been found to have issued defamatory statements, like in the Daimler case or like in the Tucker case. But to your point, and I think this court even said, and Your Honor was part of the panel in the Gibney case.
Well, does an attorney have immunity for what he says in response to a complaint filed?
Well, in certain instances they do, but we're dealing with pre-complaint statements that are made in this case, and I don't think that issue was really before here. But nevertheless, there have been cases where, like the Daimler-Chrysler case, and the Tucker case, which was involved the estate of Tupac Shakur, where those attorneys were found to have issued defamatory statements. Getting back, Your Honor, to the point I was going to make in Gibney, it is important that the statements be viewed as they are received by the average listener, and that point was made in Gibney. And here, the fact that Martin Singer is, in fact, the spokesman for Bill Cosby, that he has been his lawyer, would give more credence and more weight to the average listener to what he's saying, much like the Oprah Winfrey statements that were made, because Ms. Winfrey was the owner of the school and she was making statements about the headmistress.
But everyone understands that a lawyer is going to advocate for their client, whether inside the well of a courtroom or out on the courthouse steps. So context in this case suggests that a listener would have that fact and know that a lawyer can speak in colorful language, I think as written in our Remick case, and that alone is certainly not enough. And in Remick, indeed, the language of the statement at issue said something to the effect of, if you insist on attempting to extort money, using the word extortion, and that was not found to be defamatory, how can this statement by Singer be found to be defamatory when actually using the word extortion was not?
Right. Well, certainly there is no doubt, and we in no way take issue with the fact that a lawyer can zealously represent their client and they can use the most unkind words, but that in no way changes the idea that they cannot use undisclosed facts and innuendo to do so.
What undisclosed fact was do you contend was buried in that statement?
Well, there were several, and there's a series of innuendos that Mr. Singer peppers his statement with. This allusion to people who will do anything against rich and powerful men, and lawyers, there are greedy lawyers out there that will do anything, much akin to the Donald Trump.
Well, that's an opinion that he has, and the facts that substantiate his opinion. How can that be defamatory?
At the very end of, well, you take it in context, and it's not about, you said, Your Honor, about the word extort. And I started off by saying, if you cherry-pick words and just say...
This is a lawyer speaking now. It's not someone that's speaking technically, of course.
Absolutely. But it's not about just saying, what's the strongest word? Blackmail, extort, paranoid, schizophrenic. The courts have said that that's not the appropriate test. And, in fact, in Remick, the case that you just noted, the court there was careful to point out that in the appropriate context, that same word could be defamatory. So, again, it gets back to context. But I do want to point out in the Singer statement that in addition to just making this innuendo, at the very end of his statement he says this, over and over again, we have refuted these new unsubstantiated stories with documentary evidence. He uses the word documentary evidence as a lawyer to make it sound as though that there has been some type of investigation, that in fact there's documentary evidence out there that would disprove this.
Not on this allegation, but in regard to past allegations.
Well, that is correct, Your Honor, but I think the implication from that is in every single instance we've knocked all of these down with documentary evidence, which, by the way, is not factually supported.
But the facts that he's basing his opinion on are in what he says. There aren't implied undisclosed facts that he's talking about.
Well, the position below on the part of the defendant was that the facts that are disclosed are twofold. First, that Singer states the length of time between the accusations when they were made and when the deeds took place, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. And the other factual basis that they cite is that this idea that there are rich and powerful men who are subject to lawyers, aggrieved lawyers. So let's take both of those. With respect to the
lawyers, they're all true. You'll acknowledge that all those statements are true.
I do not. I will grant you, Your Honor, that the very first statement, you could say the length of time. It's factual. You could say that is in part fact. But it's also implication. There's a clear implication that's being made by that, the length of time. Why didn't these women come forward? Well, there's a couple of explanations. Maybe they're lying, right?
Well, you're entitled to your opinion. I'm entitled to my opinion. It's a difference of opinion. But well, isn't he clearly putting forth his opinion?
And the facts that his opinion is based on. Now, you may not agree that this basis is a valid basis, but that is recognized as opinion that the person reading the statement and looking at the facts that it's based on can say, oh, well, that's not very likely to be true, or, oh, yeah, I really agree with him.
Well, that's exactly what this court, the circuit, said in the Redco case, right? And it talked about the importance. I mean, they're all opinions when you really look at it, right? And so is it a pure opinion or a mixed opinion? And so has the person that's stated that opinion done so in a way that allows the person who's evaluating it to make a judgment based on something that's real or something that's in your
life. So let me ask you something. You're an attorney. You represent someone that's been accused. What can you say without getting in trouble with the defamation law? What can you say?
You can say a whole lot. You can use unkind words.
These were unkind words.
They certainly were, but they were more than that. And that's why it's not just...
Well, what can you say? What can you say if you're accused of...
well, Your Honor...
That you think would be a safe harbor.
With due respect, it depends. And I'll answer your question in this way. I could use very nice words, right? I mean, if you take a look at what Oprah Winfrey said...
In response to Judge Cowan, Ms. Hill made a statement.
Yes.
You know what that statement was.
Right.
Your counsel for Mr. Cosby, what is it within bounds to say in response to that? I think that's what
I could
would like to hear.
If we wanted to pick out words and language, I would submit to the court that I could use even stronger words than what Mr. Singer used and still be safe.
Like what? Give us an example of what you would say if you were in Singer's position representing his client.
I can tell you this, that when he's talking about this idea of these women who bring up there's no shortage of lawyers who will go after rich, powerful men. And so it makes no sense that not one of these women who just came forward had ever asserted a legal claim before. I mean, the clear implication there is that they're making this up and that they're after money. Now, he doesn't come out and say that. You could, as an attorney, I could use the word extort or blackmail defending my client, as we know, because of Remick, as we know, because of Greenbelt. So it really does depend on the context. When you read these three statements together or independently, as the court in Green versus Mitzner said, it's not whether or not they're defamatory. That's not the question for the court. If there are competing alternative interpretations, one that's entirely benign, but one that could conceivably be defamatory, then the case should go to the jury. That's exactly what the court...
As long as it's an opinion, why do you have to... it's not even or. An opinion is going to be your opinion. And you know what's bothering me about this case? If someone is accused of a horrendous wrongdoing, the federal law is that if that person does not deny it vehemently, when a trial occurs later on about that statement, if the person doesn't deny the allegation, a jury is charged. This is a federal charge accepted. A jury may infer the fact that you did not vehemently deny the allegation. A jury may, but is not required, to infer from that fact that the statement is true. So that there's a real free speech a component here for someone in Crosby's position. And if you don't deny it vehemently, a jury later on can be charged that that's to be taken as evidence that that you couldn't deny it.
I understand, but denying it and accusing somebody of and linking them to people that had made up false rape allegations, as Camille Cosby did, are two different things. I think my time is up.
Any further questions this round? Okay. Counsel, you may see. We'll see you on rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, first I'd like to thank you for the Court's indulgence for allowing me to appear today on behalf of Defendant Kelly, Mr. William Cosby. My name is Angela Grusa. Context is very important here, and the allegations that are laid out in the complaint themselves set forth the context, and that is, by her own admissions, plaintiff Helen contends that on November 13, an op-ed piece was written by another accuser to the Washington Post to be published. On November 13, a group of other women came forward making accusations, and that she herself came forward several days later. The Singer statement that's alleged is a statement that Mr. Singer wrote to the Washington Post in response to the publication of accusations made. The statement is pure opinion, as the court ruled. It, if anything, is an indictment to the journalistic standards that he opined were not being applied in repeating accusations.
Isn't that more true of the statement maybe of Mr. Cosby and Mrs. Cosby than Singer?
It isn't, because the point of this stating that they are unsubstantiated and concluding that this is an example of the media's breakneck rush to run stories without any corroboration or adherence to traditional journalistic standards. The context of this letter to the editor of the Washington Post is reprimanding the Washington Post for failing to adhere proper journalistic standards.
But the first sentence of it talks about claims that are being characterized as unsubstantiated fantastical stories. Isn't that a comment more on the source of the stories, not on the media?
Unsubstantiated means no evidence has yet been produced. Doesn't mean it's false. Doesn't mean it's true. It means we are waiting for substantiation, which in essence is akin to the requirement that people be deemed innocent until proven guilty. That, in essence, is the context of Mr. Singer's statement.
Well, the Singer statement, how is that any different than the statements in Tucker and Dabler, Chrysler and Green? Attorneys were not given any immunity because they're attorneys for making statements which are outlandish.
It's interesting. The Tucker case is very distinguishable. In Tucker, a complaint had been filed and a lawyer came out and made a statement. He chastised the plaintiff for seeking recovery for lack of sexual relations. An amended complaint was then filed in which the lack of consortium claim was very clearly eliminating recovery for lack of sex. The lawyer, in receipt of that first amended complaint, continued to issue statements stating that the plaintiff, ridiculing the plaintiff for seeking damages for lack of sexual activity. The lawyer in that case was simply going above and beyond stating his opinion. He was misstating allegations. He was misreporting facts. And that gave rise to the court's assessment. And under those circumstances,
he was making statements like extortion and some other, making criminal statements.
Well, we know under the line of cases, whether it's Fram or Remick, that a lawyer's opinion of whether a claim is extortion is protected. Here, the claims, the statements in Mr. Singer's letter are very circumspect. They do not rise anywhere near the level of claiming extortion or false reporting. Here, we have a simple situation of the classic, the First Amendment, freedom of speech, is not a one-way street.
Well, I meant to ask your adversary, do you have a claim here that we're dealing with any type of limited public figure here in these women making this statement and thrusting themselves into what is a national known case at this point?
Our opposite, first, we believe this is pure opinion. And yes, the appellant here, plaintiff here, injected herself into the public space and created a limit or an implied public figure, quasi-public figure, a status.
How does she do that, though? Because isn't part of the public figure, limited public figure analysis, also that the dispute in which one insinuates itself into is a type of dispute that would affect those outside of the dispute? So it may be newsworthy because that's what the media might be interested in, but doesn't really fall into that category such that both components of the limited public figure analysis are satisfied.
In the context of the time period in which this was happening, Ms. Hill, along with a number of other women, had begun to step forward and make very public accusations. It was a virtual firestorm of daily statements made by accusers, with the Washington Post, as is alleged in the complaint, stepping forward. In doing that, these women led a movement, as we've now seen play out over the course of this year, in which they very proudly established themselves as leaders of this movement, contending that there was a serial pattern of misconduct by my client. By insinuating herself into the public space, and more importantly, by making extremely, I would call it inflammatory even, provocative allegations, she was inviting a response. The fact that defendant or someone speaking on his behalf would deny those allegations should have come as no surprise to her. The fact that a defendant or someone speaking on his behalf would call out facts that would call into question whether the claims had yet been vetted should not have come as a surprise to her. None of the statements in Mr. Singer's letter to the editor to the Washington Post should have come as a surprise to her.
Is that the test?
No, but it does go in line with the cases that say when an individual raises a subject that is certainly going to have an impact on the accused, they should not be surprised when the accused responds, particularly when it's a lawyer whose job it is to do that. A lawyer's job is to respond to the accusations made against his or her client.
Yeah, but the response is more than a response. It's a response saying that that criminal conduct was afoot.
Certainly the accusation is that he engaged in a crime, and Mr. Singer's statement, absolutely appropriately responsive to that, is, was there a police report? Has anyone vetted to see if a civil claim was due? In fact, there wasn't. He is responding very much to the nature of the claims that are being asserted, in the context of the nature of the claims that are being asserted. Mm-hmm. He was doing exactly what a lawyer would be expected to do, which is why his statements would fall under the category of opinion by a lawyer.
Well, the question before us and other it's the law is a lawyer can overstep his defense position. Whether this statement by Singer goes beyond substantiating what was an opinion, if we deem this an opinion, which would be looking at it as, in a light most favorable to Singer.
I have not seen, nor have I heard from the opposition here, anything that would transplant the statements in this letter to the editor, into something other than attorney opinion. There is really no implied defamatory contact. And certainly to the extent even the court were to have concluded that, the statements, the facts that support Mr. Singer's opinion are laid out.
Well, your first line of defense is what? This is, they are not other concerning his client.
Our first line of defense, these are pure opinions from the lawyer.
And they're not defamatory in any sense.
They're not
defamatory. And if they are, they're not other concerning your...
Correct, absolutely.
His client.
There's absolutely no reference to our client. They are...
But who else could it be referenced to? You know, that was part of your briefing. It's not other concerning, but who else could they be referring to?
They were of a generic nature in the sense that to the extent people are coming forward with claims that are 30, 40, and 50 years old against our clients, they are suspicious. They need to be substantiated. That's the essence of it.
And so what are the disclosed facts that in the Singer statement that you contend make it a protected opinion and immune from defamation liability?
The fact he states very clearly and succinctly, the facts that they were brand new, that they were never before heard, that they were stories about things that occurred 30, 40, and 50 years ago, and that they were decades old events, that during that period of time, the accusers had said nothing, had not made police reports or gone to law enforcement, had not asserted civil claims, and on that basis, he asserts that they have been unsubstantiated.
And so that laundry list you just gave us should allow a listener to make a judgment as to whether this opinion should be accepted or not. And that's why, from your view, it's not subject to liability.
That's correct. He has laid out the basis for his opinion so that reader could say, well, I don't think that's a strong enough basis or not. But the basis is there.
Well, the question is what a reasonable person would consider this, an opinion, or whether they consider it a statement of more akin to the cases which have held attorneys liable for saying a little too much.
If anything, the nature of the manner in which he has laid out the basis for his opinion is far more descriptive than in cases in which we have seen the courts have found.
It's more descriptive, but the language is graphic. The language is basic criminal allegation language. Descriptive, yeah, I agree with you, but the words, when you use the word extortion, you're talking about criminal law. You're not talking about using pressure, you know.
Do you think that there's anything in the Singer statement from which one could infer extortion? Because the word extortion doesn't appear there.
There is nothing from the language that one could infer extortion. And quite frankly, I think to the extent that counsel had addressed the court or directed the court's attention to the language in which, in fact, I think Mr. Singer is more critical of our fellow lawyers than the accuser when he says that there are lawyers who will file lots of claims for people. That's not extortion implication by any stretch. That's simply saying there are a lot of hungry lawyers out there.
Turning to Mr. Cosby's statement for a moment.
Sure.
There was a representation in the brief, but it wasn't in the complaint, that this statement came on the heels of a radio station encouraging people going to one of his shows to act out and heckle. Is that an accurate context? It's not a complaint, but that was in the brief.
Once again, that would be a situation in which the entire context of the statement would need to be addressed.
But we only can rely on what's in the complaint because motion to dismiss stage. So that's not, we can't rely on representation, right? We can only rely on what the statement is.
It's my understanding, in the briefing below, the court was drawn attention to the full context of the statement, and it was provided to the district court as to complete the record.
So there's no dispute as to the sequence of events that led to Mr. Cosby's statements, is that correct?
No.
Okay.
Hard choice. Which of the statements do you feel are the most easily classified as defamatory?
Oh. I don't think either.
I have to make a choice now. You know, we're going to put you on the
least defamatory of all. The most.
Either way,
The closest to defamatory.
I apologies to the court. I have seen a lot of defamatory statements and have read a number of cases. I am at a loss.
They're all the same. They're all the same.
If there's anyone who can claim they've been defamed in any stretch of the imagination, perhaps the lawyer, perhaps the bar of our various courts.
Because the journalists.
I think there's so much truth in that statement that I have a hard time even suggesting that that might have been defamatory.
When Mr. Cosby, in his last line of that statement, says, I know people are tired of me not saying anything, but a guy doesn't have to answer to innuendos. People should fact check. People shouldn't have to go through that and should have to answer to innuendos. Is there anything that we should construe from that as a suggestion that the sources of these accusations are less than credible?
No, I think that falls in the identical category of making a statement that something is unsubstantiated. Innuendo does not mean something is false. It simply means that until an innuendo is established, until it is given context and information to support it, it can be either true or false. In that sense, until he, again, person who's been accused, entitled to be presumed innocent until proven guilty, until he is proven guilty, it is still an innuendo. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you.
Before you get started, I'm interested in your response to the question we asked your adversary. Which of these three do you feel as if is your best shot at the defamatory statement?
I'm not going to defer or dodge the question. I'll answer it directly. I think that the Singer and the Camille Cosby statements are much closer to the line. I think, frankly, that the Bill Cosby statement, there's just quite not as much there. I do think, though, that the statements really can be taken in context as a concerted effort, because the Martin Singer statement and the William Cosby statement were actually made on the same day.
Your position is directly contrary to the position for the very reason we have a statute of limitations. And you're arguing against the statute of limitations. But what Singer said is his statement is in praise of the statute of limitations, where these people have been for 40 years.
Right, Your Honor. And in answering to when you asked counsel, I don't know if it was you or any of the other judges that said, what's the factual basis? Counsel only talked about one thing, and that's the length of time issue. And perhaps if that was the only thing that was alluded to, then maybe it would be a closer call. But Singer does more than that. He not only says, boy, there's been a lot of time since this has happened. He then goes out and makes a statement that is almost word for word. If you read the Daimler-Chrysler opinion in terms of what the court found actionable, it's almost exactly the same. Here's what the Daimler court found actionable. For too long, lawyers have been exploiting class actions, turning these lawsuits into a form of legalized blackmail, and frivolously filed because they believe that the threat of massive class actions can coerce a company into settlement. Martin Singer says almost the same thing with respect to these women. He says these women who have come forward in the past 2 weeks, and then he says there has never been a shortage of lawyers willing to represent people with claims against rich, powerful men. So it makes no sense that none of these women who just came forward didn't do it before. So
but isn't it an indictment of the bar, not the accusers?
Absolutely not. He's talking about these women. If you look at the context of the statement,
he's not saying that the women have a valid claim. He's saying that there are lawyers because the person being accused is rich. We'll go over after that lawyer whether the claim is or not.
The question is whether or not there are alternative interpretations. Let's suppose for somehow and concede that Martin Singer is actually making a critique of the in support of the statute of limitations. I mean, conceivably you could say that. Frankly, I don't think that that's a very plausible thing when you read this in context. He's pointing his finger at these women and saying, look, they didn't do this for so long. What does that mean? I mean, he didn't certainly posit the other part of it, which is women who are sexually abused, people that are sexually abused might be reluctant to come forward. He didn't say that. The clear implication is that they made it up. When you couple that with the greed of lawyers and people who will come out and go after rich and powerful men, it's certainly clear that the implication there.
The basis for his opinion is there. Now, whether that's a good basis or a bad basis, if his opinion is based on facts 1, 2, 3, and facts 1, 2, 3 are in the statement, then the person reading the statement, reading the opinion, reading the basis for the opinion, can say, boy, that guy is full of hooey, or he is absolutely right.
Your Honor, it all depends what facts 1, 2, and 3 are, I would suggest to the court. And I would compare the facts 1, 2, 3 here, which are clearly just implication and undisclosed facts, to the facts 1, 2, 3, for example, in the Gibney case, where there was a reference about why the claims were unsubstantiated. They were because we actually did an investigation, and our opinion is that it exonerated these people. When Martin Singer talks about, sorry, Your Honor, there being documentary evidence, there is no documentary evidence. I understand that he's basically saying we've always refuted these with documentary evidence, and all these other things. When you take these statements and put them together, the facts 1, 2, 3 aren't real facts. They're not really there. It's innuendo. It's rich people get attacked all the time. I mean, I don't know if that's a fact.
One of the facts here that I don't think anyone touched on, and certainly not your adversary, is why isn't your client a limited public figure at this point? She made a statement about an issue which is brewing nationally. It's been in every newspaper. To the extent she's a limited figure, public figure, and you've made no allegation of any actual malice here. Perhaps you've said this is a wild statement to make, and it's defamatory, but there's nothing about being actually malicious so that the statement is. I don't think you did anything until the reply brief, certainly not your main brief.
Well, I'm going to address those issues. First of all, is she a limited public figure? The answer is no. And Judge Schwartz pointed out the Firestone case. I don't think it meets the standard of that being the case. Also, in terms of Renita Hill throwing herself in with some of these other women as they were characterized, she spoke one time ever.
There's no requirement to be a limited public figure that you have to speak a dozen times. You can speak one time. If they speak, I could write one time.
I understand.
Yeah, that's not, you know.
I understand, but let me just.
Excuse me.
No. I want to make sure that you were done, of course, but I wanted to undercut this whole thing get to the point of it, which is I don't think it matters. And it doesn't matter because this is really a pleading issue. And if you read in our brief, we have, in essence, if you read the complaint as a whole, we have certainly pled actual malice here.
Where have you pled in your complaint actual malice?
We have. As detailed in the brief, I think there are three paragraphs where we basically say that Cosby, when he speaks, he's speaking through those persons who are charged and able to speak on his behalf, including Singer and Camille Cosby. And we say then that the statements that were made by those individuals were made with malice. So
that's conclusory.
Yeah.
Under the law, if you're accusing a public figure of actual malice, you have to put down the fact. You can't have a conclusory allegation. I agree with my colleague that I saw nothing in this case that spelled out actual malice. And if this person is a limited public figure, then at most you could say is that the statement by Singer and the rest of her are wild, stupid, inarticulate ways of speaking. But you can't say it bespeaks a basic disdain, hatred, and the malicious requirement for actual malice.
Your Honor, I'll just note that issue was briefed below, and the court did not use that as a reason. We still briefed it, but the court didn't use that as a reason for dismissal. And in our brief below, we requested leave of court to amend the complaint to the extent that the court did not find that was sufficiently pled, although I do think that it is when you read the complaint as a whole. And so just to button up this point, to the extent that the court were to feel that, we would request leave to amend the complaint. I don't think that it would be futile. It would be quite easy to do. And frankly, with all due respect, I do think that it was pled sufficiently if you read it in total.
Okay, thank you for your arguments.
Thank you.
For a very well-argued case. And we'll call the next case. We'll take the matter under